Hi, friends, and welcome to Sermonsmith. This is a podcast of conversations about the craft of sermon preparation. And with me today is one of my fellow Austinites. I am with Juan Sanchez, and Juan is the pastor of High Point Baptist Church here in Austin. How are you, Juan?
I am doing great and glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad that you were able to join us. Juan, even before we jump in to actual sermon prep, why don't you tell us a little bit about your context, High Point, what part of the city it's in, what the congregation looks like, that kind of thing.
Sure. High Point is actually not the original name of the church. High Point was a merger of two churches. The main church body was Christ Memorial Baptist Church, which was planted in 1975. The founding pastor was James Weaver. It was founded on the east side of 35 around Kramer Lane area. And in the late 1990s, they decided to move to the other side, buy some property. There was a church called Trinity Covenant Baptist Church that was meeting. And in God's providence, they met together and decided rather than competing against each other, they merged.
Yeah.
So in April 1998, Trinity Covenant Baptist Church and Christ Memorial Baptist Church became High Point Baptist Church.
Okay.
So they met in the building of Trinity Covenant Baptist Church until they built the building where we are on Dessau, and they moved into this building in 2001 of April.
Yeah. And what is that? What's that neighborhood like? I have my impressions.
Sure. What are your impressions?
My impression, well, just because it's close to Dell, you know, and I certainly know that there are several other ethnic churches nearby, but I would imagine it's typically a fairly diverse area, but an educated diversity. Would that be safe to say?
I think so. I think that's pretty fair. I mean, I haven't looked at the demographics lately, but what we have here is people want to move closer to Austin. They realize it gets expensive. And so you have the crowd that wants to be close to Austin, but can't afford quite, you know, what
the
Austin offers.
Yeah.
That's right. And so what you have is people that are moving as close to Austin as they can afford. And so it actually is very diverse. We have a very large Vietnamese Roman Catholic church behind us. And so I think that functions as, if I understand correctly, as also as a Vietnamese community center. So there's a large Vietnamese community right around us. But the demographics are within the 3 miles, I think it is about 29% Hispanic and 28% Anglo.
Hmm.
It's a little bit odd because like you said, it's, I think the demographic category is Nuevo Latino. So it's young Hispanics who are, have a college degree or buying their first house.
Yeah.
So they may not necessarily be first generation. Or their first generation that were educated here. But it is quite a diverse community. And our church actually reflects that diversity, even though over 50% of our people come from outside of 5 miles.
Hmm, okay.
So people drive in, a lot of people drive in from beyond the 5 miles. But one of the unique things I think about High Point, which I think was the original vision of the founding pastor, was the multi-ethnicity that now has become not just multi-ethnic but also multicultural. And so so we have Hispanics, Anglos, African-Americans, a good number of Africans, actually. We have an Ethiopian pastor that serves on our staff, we had a young lady from Liberia who was in our membership class just this Sunday morning. And so it's just really encouraging for me personally.
Sure.
To see the diversity of the body of Christ, not just ethnically, but also culturally. You know, we have a good number of families from India and some Asian families. So it's a sweet congregation to be a part of.
And you mentioned you have an African language worship service. It looks like you have a Spanish-speaking worship service as well.
We do, but that's a little bit different. So what happened is originally we wanted to reach the Hispanic population around here, and so we had a Spanish service that I was preaching, and it just got to be too much for me to preach, you know, in Spanish at 9 o'clock and English at know, 10 o'clock, then again at 6 o'clock in English. So we actually ended up planting that church out of High Point.
Okay.
So that was our first church plant, was a Hispanic church. And so we've kind of got them going, got them on our own. Since then, we have shifted a little bit our focus. And we, in addition to having an Amharic-speaking pastor who helps us reach the Amharic population, they do have a language service, but they're incorporated into our membership, and we're really trying to work hard to be one church. In January, we brought on a young man from Monterrey, Mexico, on our staff, who's going to help us start trying to think of how do we reach the second generation Hispanic population, and then perhaps expand from there to reach the first generation as well. So he's starting a small group in Spanish here in the next couple of weeks or so.
Got it. When you were growing up, what language did you speak at home?
I was born in Puerto Rico.
Okay.
And so for the first 8 years of my life, all I knew was Spanish. And we moved to a little town in Central Florida called Avon Park when I was 8 years old. And my parents threw me right into summer school. I knew nothing of English. And so I had to sink or swim, and the third grade was pretty rough. But but even though English is my second language, because I learned it from such a young age and learned it in school and not on the street or growing up in the home, I'm more functional in English and pretty comfortable, more comfortable writing in English.
Yeah.
But I do a lot in Spanish. You know, I travel a lot in the Spanish-speaking world, preaching and doing conferences, and so I'm very functional in both.
And that's why I ask, because I mean I would have guessed just from interactions I've had with you that you were English first,
right?
Just because you speak English, it just seems like it's your heart language. So,
right.
Do you find it's tricky to move in and out of the two? Do you find it's more natural to preach in one over the other?
Yeah, it's really funny. You know, earlier this year in February, I was in Cuba for about 8 days, and then I turned around and then went to Puerto Rico for a few days. And that next Sunday, I came into the pulpit. I was preaching, and I was actually having trouble shifting back into English.
Huh.
And I found myself struggling for words in English because I was still kind of in Spanish mode. So it took me a little bit to get back into it.
Yeah. I don't have anything that relates to that experience, so that's why I can ask. Well, tell us, what is within High Point? High Point is Southern Baptist, am I correct?
It is.
Yeah.
What we like to say is we're in friendly cooperation with the Southern Baptist Convention.
Okay.
It is not a denomination that has a hierarchical structure.
Right.
It's more of a cooperation of churches for the purpose of mission.
Yes.
And so what people don't understand is the Southern Baptist Convention actually doesn't exist except for 2 days of the year in June, where Southern Baptists send their representatives from members of different churches, and they convene for 2 days. That's actually the Southern Baptist Convention. And so the churches are autonomous.
And you're talking the National Southern Baptist.
Yes, yes, the National Southern Baptist Convention.
And then do you also have affiliation with Texas Southern Baptists or Baptist General Convention?
Well, yeah, now you're getting into a little Southern Baptist politics. And
well, I don't want to get, I'm just trying to.
Yeah, so basically the way that it works is the local church is autonomous, but in order to reach people with the gospel and plant churches, Southern Baptists have erected different structures. So there's the national structure that kind of organizes at the national level, and we do have some entities like Lifeway Christian Resources is our publishing arm, you know, and then you have the seminaries and those kinds of things. But at the state level, there are state conventions that kind of help churches organized together to reach that particular state. And then even here in Austin, we have what's called an Austin Baptist Association, which is just an association of local Southern Baptist churches.
Yeah. I'm not trying to back into politics, just framing context.
absolutely. Absolutely.
So what do you see within the congregation of High Point? Like, what do you see as being the role of preaching?
Yeah. Well, I believe preaching shapes the congregation. You know, that a lot of what we do, whether we do it purposely or unconsciously, we do what we do shapes the church. So, for example, whether it's the music that we select and sing, you know, the, even down to the instrumentation that we use or how loud it is or how soft it is, you know, what ends up happening is, I was mentioning this Sunday morning, David Wells, in his book, The Courage to Be Protestant, in chapter 5, talks about the turn toward the self, you know, and the culture of self-fulfillment. And, you know, we have so imbibed in that culture of self-fulfillment that Americans seem to look for churches as consumers.
Yeah.
And so based upon what we do, we don't realize it, but we are doing things that attract certain consumers and repel certain consumers. And so what we understand is that if anything should shape the church, it shouldn't be the children's ministry. Hey, we have the best children's ministry in town, or the music ministry. It should be the preaching. And so for us, preaching is central to the life of the church. And what I like to say is preaching is central, but it's not enough. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, you know, I tell our staff, it's important to understand that people may come to High Point because they appreciate the preaching, the teaching, that it's rooted in God's word. You know, regardless of who's preaching on our preaching staff, that's the kind of preaching that they'll encounter. It is expositional in nature. We want to make sure that the point of the text is the point of the sermon applied to the people. And so there's a continuity, even though there's different ways that each preacher is doing that. And so there's a certain attraction for people that are hungry for the word of God. There's a sense in, by preaching expositional, there's a certain understanding, okay, the word is being taken seriously. And that, believe it or not, can attract a certain kind of consumer. You know, there's also theological consumers.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you know, I want to make sure that we're very careful that we're not just, you know, doing a different kind of consumerism. And so we want to make sure that we're very careful and try to understand, you know, that the gospel is central to what we do, and that in our preaching, the gospel comes out clearly, and that's what's shaping the congregation. It is the power of the gospel preached through the word of God, consecutively and systematically through books. That is what's shaping the congregation, that we're always tearing away at the consumeristic mindset, you know, through application and exposing idols and, you know, exposing wrong thinking, renewing of our minds, you know, replace old ways of thinking with new ways of thinking. And the reason I say preaching is central, but it's not enough, is because what we find is that people will come and are drawn to biblical gospel preaching, but if they don't have relationships and community, they're not going to stay necessarily.
Yeah.
So what we found is that people will stay at unhealthy churches because they have good relationships, and they may actually leave good churches because they have no relationships or biblical community.
For sure. Yeah. Okay. That's obviously one that you've spent time talking through and thinking through a lot within the life of your congregation.
Yes.
I didn't prep you for that question, and you had an answer ready to go. So. Well, you just alluded to this a little bit, and I know from looking at your website that it looks like you typically, for your sermons, you just work exegetically through a text. It doesn't look like you follow the lectionary or anything like that. So how do you determine what you're going to preach through? How far in advance do you schedule Sundays?
Yeah, that's a great question. We don't necessarily follow the Christian calendar. Okay. There may be an occasion where like we'll have a Good Friday service, you know, in a couple of weeks here. But for Easter, I'm just preaching the next text that comes along in Matthew.
Yeah.
And it happens to be Matthew 18.
Okay.
Now, I have preached Easter messages in the past, so we've done both. But kind of one of the things that I said this in the last couple of weeks, you know, we want to make sure that every Lord's Day is a celebration of the resurrection. So as Christians, we're celebrating the resurrection every Sunday.
Yeah.
There's some natural cultural rhythms that we want to be aware of. So, for example, if if a 9/11 happens and we completely ignore it, I think that may not be helpful. So I think there are times in our culture, there might be situations that call us to change the pattern of where we're going and say, okay, I need to address this specifically. And so, for example, in the life of our church, I sense, you know, we really need to strengthen marriages. And this is where, for us, a plurality of elders is really helpful. So it's not all on me. And we're thinking about the congregation and thinking about, you know, how are people doing? We have young couples. And so there are two things that we've been talking about as elders. You know, how do we strengthen marriages? Because we do enough marital counseling that we know, you know, that we have a lot of people struggling with marriages.
Sure.
And so I took about 3 weeks and I dealt with the topic of marriage using three expositional messages, but they were on marriage. So I took specific texts that dealt with that. But generally, we're preaching through books of the Bible, trying to preach the whole counsel of God, trying to have a balanced diet of Old Testament and New Testament. So that's one of the things that's going on in our mind. How do we preach the whole counsel of God? And, you know, a lot, it seems to me, at least in my tradition of Southern Baptist, that doesn't happen very much. That's one of the ways where people who follow the lectionary, it's more helpful because you have that balanced diet.
Yeah.
And that's foreign to our tradition. But what we try to do is have that kind of balanced diet that, say, a lectionary provides, but in on a larger, big picture scale. So we're trying to go Old Testament and New Testament, but not just Old Testament and New Testament, because there are different types of genre. And so, you know, there's some people that are drawn just to Paul's letters. And so, you know, if all they're preaching from the New Testament is Paul's letters, that's not as helpful. So what we want to do is have the balanced diet of Old Testament and New Testament, but also different types of literary genre.
Yeah.
So in the Old Testament, we might preach a historical narrative. Then we might go to, First Peter. And then when we go to the Old Testament, we might do poetry or wisdom literature, and then come back and do a gospel in the New Testament. So that our folks are exposed to the whole counsel of God from the Old Testament and New Testament and the various genre of biblical literature.
And when you do an exegetical text, do you try to do pericope at a time, chunk at a time, or do you try to just capture some themes? Because Matthew's a commitment. I mean, you're
sure.
Right smack dab in the middle of it, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm in Matthew. I just finished Matthew 16 Sunday. You know, people ask, well, how long have you been in Matthew? I don't remember. I could pull it up.
Right.
But it's been a couple of years, but it's not been a couple of years steadily. You know, and I'm ignorant in many ways, but I'm observant enough to understand I am no Martin Lloyd Jones. You know, so I'm not going to take two words a week and, you know, spend years and years and years in a particular book of the Bible. He was able to do that because he had particular gifts and unique gifts. And I think that's the mistake sometimes we preachers make is, you know, we read a Lloyd Jones and we think, okay, we have to preach like Lloyd Jones. And so we're preaching one verse, you know, a day. I think we have to know our congregation and preach to the congregation we have and not the congregation we want. You know, so you have folks that are listening to all these preachers and then they think that they're going to preach to their congregation that same way. And so I think part of it is this is where pastoring to me is so important to preaching.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the better pastor you are, the better preacher you actually are as well, because the application is connected to the actual shepherding. And you're not just preaching generally to a crowd, but you're preaching to your people.
Yeah.
And for me, preaching is not rocket science. I mean, it is very hard work, but it's not rocket science. And for me, preaching is shepherding. And in shepherding, all I'm trying to do is I'm up front, the sheep are behind me, and I'm trying to lead them from where they are to the presence of Christ. And so to me, that's just the very basic concept that I have in my mind of preaching. You know, so it's not a performance. It's not, I hit it out of the park. It's what do I need to do to communicate to our sheep? Don't stop running. You know, keep your eyes fixed on Jesus. You know, you're believing lies about this. And so I'm trying to let the text guide me in that, in order to let the whole counsel of God speak to our people. But it's just simply, okay, High Point, you know, here's where we are. Here's what our text is saying. This is where we're going. You know, press on, persevere, believe the truth, stop believing lies, you know, and applying that to our people.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, thus the pastoring is so important.
Yes.
Because you know, you have to know and be engaged with your people to do that.
That's exactly right. I would, it seems to me like if you're just a preacher, and it's ironic because my title here is officially preaching pastor, but I'm some people call it lead pastor, some call it senior pastor. I'm one of several pastors. I just happen to have the focus of the preaching ministry, setting the preaching ministry of the church. And I do have a plurality of elders that helps me and speaks into that and encourages me. Like if I'm preaching a text and we have service review every week, we just had that this morning, and the guys come back and say, you know what, this is something in the text that I think our congregation would be helped by if you went back and addressed again. You know, so we just want to always be thinking, not I'm getting through a book and now they know Matthew, but what from Matthew is helping us get from where we are into the presence of Christ.
So even as you're working through Matthew, it sounds like, based on what you just said, you might not have the next 6 weeks or the next 6 months specifically detailed on, I'm going to cover this text this day, because you want to work through it as it comes?
I do both. So okay. Theoretically, my oldest daughter got married in August, and so I wasn't able to do that this summer. But generally what I do is we take 3 weeks vacation as a family. We go to the beach. That's what we enjoy doing. And during the off time, like when my family's asleep or, you know, before they awake, I'm reading through the text of Scripture that I'm going to be preaching. And I'm thinking through so that my goal is that by the end of that 3 weeks, I have the next year preaching kind of planned out generally. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have what I call a preaching plan, and at the very top, it always has a word tentative. So tentative preaching.
Everything's schedule. Tentative until the final prayer.
That's exactly right. So I do have the general understanding. And so like I have, you know, I was able to do it like until after Easter or something, or maybe through May. And so I have that far out. But as I'm going week by week, I'm open to whether or not I need to tweak that, you know, or take more text or take less text. But generally, I do try to take, as you mentioned, a pericope. I want to make sure that the flow of thought is natural. But there might be some times, like, so for example, on Easter, I'm preaching Matthew 18, and I'm taking the whole chapter. But the Sunday after Easter, I'm going to come back to Matthew 18 and just deal with the text on church discipline to really work through what that looks like in a local church.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk. I mean, let's start to hone in a little bit on maybe one particular sermon. You know, at what point, so you might know what text is going to come what Sunday. So at what point do you start work on one specific Sunday's message? Is it that Monday, or do you normally have several going at a time? What is that? Take us through a sermon from start to finish. How about I say
it
that way?
Sure. The first thing I would say is that I think is as human beings and as persons, as husbands and as fathers, we live our lives in seasons.
Yeah.
So in different seasons of my life, it's looked different ways. And so I can tell you what it looks like in this season of my life.
Sure.
And what it seems to be working. So.
And this might change tomorrow is what you're saying.
Exactly. It might change. So for example, you know, I found out that I'm going to be a grandfather.
Oh, and so, congrats.
Thanks. I'm going to enter a different season of my life. You know, my youngest is 11 years old. My oldest is 22. She's the one that's married and newly with child. But, and so my wife and I are entering into a phase where our children are older and we can start dating again, and maybe she can start traveling with me, and then I'm going to be a grandfather on top of that. So it can change in the next season of life, depending upon schedule and responsibilities and roles. Mm-hmm. But right now, what I try to do is I try to begin on Monday.
Okay.
And Monday mornings are just kind of what I do Monday mornings is I like to read in my general Bible reading. One of the things that I'm always doing is reading the Bible. You know, I think Tim Keller has helpfully said, we need to always have that big understanding of the Bible. And so we should be reading, you know, multiple chapters of the Bible continually so that we always have the Bible going on in our mind. So Monday morning, I like to spend maybe a little bit of extra time in scripture reading and in prayer and then focusing my day. And then in the afternoon, what I want to be doing is begin working in the text. And so it's different where I'm working with the New Testament than if I'm working with the Old Testament, because when I'm working with the Old Testament, my Hebrew's not as strong as my Greek, but I'm also taking larger chunks of text in the Old Testament. If I'm doing historical narrative, I may take 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe even 10 chapters, depending upon, you know, what's going on in the text. I may only take one chapter, but it's longer extended. And so I'm not going to spend the time trying to work through the original text. And I'm going to let commentaries help me out on that as much.
Yeah.
But when I'm in the New Testament, I do tend to take smaller sections. And so I do begin Monday working through translating.
So you started original language.
Yeah. So that's one of the things I do, you know, use Logos to speed things up just a little bit.
Yeah.
But before I had Logos, I would just get my, you know, Greek New Testament out and my tools, and it just took me a little bit longer to work through some of that. But again, I'm trying to keep up my Greek, and it's not just to keep up my Greek, but there's sufficient help for me. What it's doing for me. So if someone says, well, I don't have training in the original languages, you know, I want to encourage them and say, look, there are good translations that have done really good work.
Yeah.
What that process does for me is it's actually embedding the text in my mind as I'm working through the translation process. Mm-hmm. So there's a factor there that's working for me to my benefit in my memory and helping me understand the text. So I'll do that. So the first thing that I do is a literal translation.
So you're not even looking at an interlinear, you're just looking at Greek.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll have my, you know, my Logos open. Uh-huh. I'll have that out.
Yeah.
And then I'm just literally translating. You know, if there's a word that I need to look up, I'll just point my cursor over rather than going up to my shelf and getting the book out and figuring that stuff. So it brings things through a little bit quicker. Mm-hmm. You know, my Greek skills are not such that I can just open the book and just read and go to town.
Yeah.
I wish it were, but it just isn't. But it is good enough to do the translation work, and it really helps me personally. So what I'll do, that's the first thing that I do, is I'll have a literal translation that's purposely pretty wooden. And what I mean by that is I'm trying to write down the order of the translation as close to the Greek as possible. So instead of, you know, your son or something, you know, it's the son of you.
You know, preserve just, word order. And
exactly. Yeah. Just trying to get a sense, you know, and then what I'll do, I'll do what's called arcing. Thomas Schreiner taught this at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And I know John Piper uses this method as well. And he's got a little booklet on biblical exegesis where he outlines how to use the arcing method. The first time I saw it, it just looked confusing to me. I had no idea what it was. But then I read through Piper's little biblical exegesis book, and he had a chart with it as well. And it just really was helpful. And what it does is it helps trace the flow of the argument. And so I go from my translation. Then I write propositions. And so I just basically write, you know, on a sheet of paper, double space, you know, the different sentences, you know, all the way down. And then what I'll do is that's where the arcing comes in. You just kind of draw an arc between all the propositions. And then you're literally tracing the flow of the argument.
Okay.
Some people accomplish the same thing by diagramming.
Yeah.
Some people might use another method. And for me, it's just a visual method that I see, okay, these ideas are together, These ideas are together. Here's a therefore. Okay, here's how that's working. And so, so from that, what I'll do, the first thing I'll do is I'll actually write an exegetical outline. So just what is this text saying, just as it is, just an exegetical outline. Mm-hmm. And that probably will be the end of Monday.
Okay.
That may be just what I do on Monday.
It's a lot of work on a Monday.
It is. But, yeah. You know, what I want to do is have some kind of understanding of where things are going. And, you know, the first and third Monday evenings, we have elders meetings. You know, so I can't do any more work on those evenings. But Monday, you know, I'll kind of wrap things up and then go home and spend the evening with my family.
Yeah.
Tuesday mornings, we have service review from 9 to 11 or 11:30. And what that is just our pastoral team getting together, and we literally evaluate every part of the service from beginning to end.
Including the sermon.
Including the sermon.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the guys go around the table and, you know, they help me or the preacher on clarity, faithfulness to the text, faithfulness and communication, helpfulness of application or lack of application. And so we're just always trying to encourage one another, help one another. And from there, the reason I do my work on Monday that I do is because there, after we finish service review, we start looking forward to the next Sunday.
Yeah.
And so I want to have some idea to tell the person that's putting together the music. I want to give them some idea as to where I'm going to be going. Mm-hmm. So that he has some ability to gather songs and be thinking about it. So we're trying to think through together the services.
Got it.
So so Tuesdays tend to be administrative mornings, and then in the afternoon I generally have meetings or discipleship, and then Wednesday is a day where nothing is on my schedule. It's completely open, and so that's when I'm gonna start thinking through, and I'm always reading.
Yeah.
So I may, you know, if I'm preaching, for example, when I was preaching Matthew 16, you know, there's a lot of questions about what it means that Peter is the rock, is, mm-hmm. you know, and the keys of the kingdom. So I may take some books with me and carry them with me and read as I'm going here and there all the time. But Wednesday is when I'm trying to come up with, okay, what am I going to need to communicate? You know, how do I preach this text? Trying to come up with some sermon outline. And, you know, it can be very general. I'll figure out the introduction and conclusion last. Sometimes the introduction comes pretty easily. Sometimes not so much. The conclusion for me is a little bit harder because I'm trying to think how to end. But Wednesday, reading commentaries if I need to. Now, on Monday, if there's a hard text, you know, like interpretation or something, I'll go to the more technical commentaries that are dealing with the grammar and those kinds of things to help me with the translation. But,
yeah.
But generally, I put commentary work toward the end.
Okay.
So that I'm not as influenced by the commentaries to come up with conclusions as much as guided if I'm just way off. If I come up to an interpretation and I'm reading all the commentaries and all the commentaries are saying the same thing and it's not what I'm saying, that's where the commentaries are really helpful for me and say, wow, I just really missed that.
Yeah, you should probably pay attention when that happens.
That's right. So theoretically, what I like to do is, again, huge theoretically, have that done by Wednesday, so that theoretically I could get up and preach the sermon. And then what I'll do is I'll just put it aside and work on other stuff for the rest of the week, you know, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. I'm always reading, always thinking. As random thoughts come to mind, I'll write it in a little journal that I carry with me or email to myself a note if I don't have the journal. And I might actually go to the laptop and open it up and write some thoughts down.
You keep all this in Word as you go, like you read it all in Word?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So I preach from an iPad, uh-huh. and so I'm actually using Pages as the final format.
Yeah.
My wife has a Mac, and so sometimes I'll work when I'm doing the typing out the sermon outline, and I do use an outline and not a manuscript. Sometimes I'll type it on there because we're hooked to the same cloud.
Yeah.
So that, you know, the work that I'm doing there, it just appears on my iPad if I want to look at it later, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not quite there yet, but I hopefully will get a Mac here in the near future. But it just facilitates the process for me.
Yeah.
But what will generally happen is when I have the ability, Saturday will be a family day generally. You know, right now I'm trying to finish up some work, so Saturdays tend to be work days. But Saturday night I'll go back and kind of think through the sermon and work it. One of the interesting things that I've never really done, but I did this a few weeks ago with my 18-year-old daughter, is we just sat at the table and I walked through the sermon with her, and she gave me some feedback.
Yeah.
And I found that so extremely helpful.
Yeah.
And so I think I'm going to begin incorporating that a little bit more, because what I found is this is where one of my weaknesses is. If I've not walked through the sermon in my mind, I have a lot of ideas in my outline, and my outlines, I try to have no more than 2 pages, 8.5 by 11 pages is 10-point font. I still want the freedom not to be tied to a manuscript.
Yeah.
Sometimes what has happened to me is I realize, and as I'm preaching, I'm processing this in one joint form for the very first time. And that can be less helpful in certain times. So what I've been trying to do to preserve some kind of extemporaneity, mm-hmm. it's kind of worked against me, because I find myself sometimes that I remembered a lot more than I thought I would. And so as I'm going extemporaneously and I come down to my notes, I realize, wow, I'm already way down here in my notes. And so I found that a couple of weeks ago doing that was really helpful to me. And I had already processed the entire content once.
Yeah.
And I think I'm going to start engaging in that practice more.
And plus, perspective of an 18-year-old female is always going to see things you didn't see.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And it really was helpful, because I was preaching Matthew 16 and dealing with the keys of the kingdom, and it was a real technical kind of explanation. And we went back and forth 2 or 3 times until she told me, now that I understand.
Yeah, nice. So really, from Wednesday p.m. until Saturday p.m., it might be percolating,
That's right.
You might come back and capture a note, but you're not really doing work on it.
No.
That's pastoring time, I take it. Yeah.
That's exactly right. And again, that's theoretical, because
you know,
as a pastor, you know, there are weddings, there are funerals, there's hospital visits, and, you know, Thursday's my day to go to the hospital. And so usually Tuesdays and Thursday afternoons are my times for appointments and for counseling and discipleship that's coordinated, you know, calendar-wise. Fridays are all day is, again, Wednesdays and Fridays are days where I ask nothing to be scheduled on those days.
Okay.
And so, you know, Friday I'm working on other stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So when you, on Wednesday, when you're putting that outline together, is there a specific structure you tend to follow, or do you kind of let the text guide that? You know, you talked about introduction and conclusion, last things you write, but how do you try to structure that outline?
Yeah, I really do try to let the text structure the outline.
Yeah.
And you know, in some places that's easier than others. I mean, it's easy in the epistles, it's less easy in historical narrative. And so I want to be less creative and more faithful to the text, but I also, you know, trying to remember the ear. And so I'm always battling, what's the best way to communicate this? And and I think sometimes variety is helpful. So, for example, sometimes the points will be communicated in application form, in imperative type form. Sometimes the outline is just simple phrases. Like this Sunday, I was preaching Matthew 16:24-28, where Jesus says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. And what I did is I took verses 21 to 23 just as a summary of what we had done before. And in verse 21 to 23, Jesus kind of explains the heart of the gospel. He says, I must go to Jerusalem, you know, because he had to die and be raised on the third day. And so the outline was real simple. One gospel, two responses, and one final judgment. For me, it seems like just having that variety may be helpful so that people don't fall into a rut, a listening rut.
Yeah. And then as you're putting that together, what do you tend to draw on for illustration material?
Yeah. So what I'm learning to work harder and harder on is the application. And sometimes the application will point me to the illustration. One of the things that I learned from a little preaching book by Matthias Media called Saving Eutychus, I found that to be a great, powerful little preaching book.
I like the title. I can imagine where that's going.
Yeah. So it's like a preaching workshop in a book form. And, you know, they talk about some really just helpful things. And one of them is illustrate the obvious. You know, we tend to illustrate what's not as clear. And so one of the things I was trying to communicate was, you know, the irony of what Jesus is saying is, if you want to save your life, you have to be willing to lose it. You know, but if you want to preserve your life, then in the end, you will lose it. It's the whole idea, you know, everyone wants to preserve their life. Everyone wants to live. But the irony is that what Jesus is saying is if you want to live, you have to be willing to die. And those who don't want to do that and rather preserve their life, they're going to end up losing it, forfeiting it. And it brought to mind Aaron Ralston, the guy who was stuck in that crevice where, you know, he wanted to live. He wants to save his life. But in order to save his life, he had to cut off his arm.
Yeah.
You know, so hopefully it emerges from, I mean, that's an obvious point, but I think the obviousness of the point and the illustration helps drive the point home. And so hopefully, you know, I'm letting the illustrations come up to help me bring the point across. Or sometimes, you know, like one of the things that I did for application is, you know, a lot of pastors are going to go to the martyrs in this text and talk about, you know, all the persecution that's taking place. And that's important for us to know and understand. But I'm afraid that if I do that, then you're going to say, oh, that's for those people over there. Yeah. So this text really isn't for me. Yeah. And so what I wanted to do is say, okay, so for us, for whom we might not be facing, you know, a sword at our neck, or what does this look like? So we talked about what does it look like to deny yourself, take up your cross daily, and follow Christ in your family, you know, in the church, in the workplace, in the world, generally. And so you know, we talked about if you're not faithful in the little things, you're not going to be faithful in, you know, when your life is called upon to suffer. And so I'm just always, again, I'm always trying to think. Preaching is just shepherding, just trying to get our folks from here to present them complete in Christ. How do I communicate this text, you know, this text where people might be tempted to say, well, you know, I don't suffer and, you know, it's not so bad being a Christian in America.
Yeah.
So that's what's driving me in thinking what I need to illustrate.
And then you mentioned earlier on that you do the language work in Logos. Then you talked about going to commentaries, whether they're in Logos or whether they're on all those bookshelves I saw.
Sure. Yeah.
Usually I do these interviews and people have their bookshelves behind them and I'm very distracted because I'm looking at all their titles. You were kind enough to not give me a view of your bookshelf.
Yeah.
But, you know, do you have some favorite commentary series? Have you loaded Logos up or do you do a lot of that stuff just off your bookshelves?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I underuse Logos. I'm not a technical person. Uh-huh. By nature. And so basically, once I'm done with my translation, I kind of close up Logos.
Okay.
And I know that Logos people are probably cringing right now.
But I don't know that anybody fully takes advantage of everything it can do.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. What I actually use more is Verso, which I think is just the library format of Logos. And so I'm reading, utilizing the Logos library through Verso. And I find myself, even though I'm not technical, doing more and more electronic reading. Mm-hmm. And so, sometimes, if I don't have the electronic book, I'll scan it and I'll email it to myself and read it on PDF reader.
That sounds pretty technical to me.
It does, but I just like to have everything with me instead of, you know, carrying a briefcase full of books.
Yeah.
So what I do is, I don't have a lot of series. You know, I have Calvin's commentaries and I have the Expositor's Bible commentary series. But what I have learned to do is find the best commentaries on that particular book. You know, so for example, right now in Matthew, I'm leaning heavily in the Expositor's Bible commentary because D.A. Carson has done that. And I think it's one of the most helpful commentaries. Now, a lot of guys that are real technical or, you know, will use, Davies, and Allison, I think it is, in the I can't remember what ICC, I think it is the ICC series. Uh-huh. I referenced that once, or twice, but I'm basically using Carson and then, France, which is in the New International Commentary of the New Testament.
Yeah.
The Pillar commentary series, I actually have a lot of respect for. And so I think I have all the ones that are out on the Pillar commentary. And so Leon Morris. Also I found Craig Blomberg is helpful in the New American commentary because he's not as verbose. And so you can get a lot of help really fast in the New American commentary that he's done on Matthew. And that's probably one of the first ones I go to just to see if my thought processes are kind of along the right lines. And, and then for devotional, I haven't once or twice the Preaching the Word series that Kent Hughes edits.
Yeah.
But I really not utilize that as much, in this series as I have others.
And then you mentioned that you're, you know, even alongside sermon prep, you mentioned you're reading all the time. So do you have any means to, as you're reading a book and you know that that's something I want to store for the future, a future sermon or something like that, do you have any means to capture and retrieve that kind of information?
Yeah, no, I'm really terrible at that. I mean, I know people have sermon file illustrations or things like that. So I'm more whatever I happen to be reading. So, for example, David Wells, we just happened to be reading that with the elders, and we had just happened in God's providence to finish chapter 5, and that served as my introduction for this message.
Yeah.
So so it's all pretty fresh, what's going on right now.
Yeah, okay. So moving on a little bit from that, though, what would be some other books that you've found, not necessarily study books, but what would be some other books that you feel like have been helpful for forming you as a preacher? They might be preaching books, they might not be.
Sure. I mean, I really read a lot of preaching books, and I don't know if every preacher feels the same way. I just feel so inadequate sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like I always need to be improving. And so I do read a lot of preaching books. But probably the books that have most shaped my life outside the Bible, the first one was probably J.I. Packer's Knowing God.
Yeah.
And that was just really foundational for me early on in my Christian faith. And then probably the second book that's impacted me the most, and I do think it impacts me in my preaching, particularly application, is Future Grace by John Piper. And it, you know, basically how to fight sin by faith in future grace. And that really revolutionized, I think, my preaching because it helped me to move away from just a legalistic type preaching, you know, do this, don't do this, or stop doing that, to more understanding how to fight sin by exposing the lies that we believe and clinging to the promises that God has given us in Christ. So it is a renewing of your mind. You know, you're replacing the false thinking from your pagan ways and replacing it with new thinking from, you know, from the gospel ways.
Yeah. Okay. Any others?
There's some books that I have that I would like to read. I think Cornelius Plantinga has that new book, Reading for Preachers.
Yeah.
And I would love to get into that.
You know, if it's helpful, that was actually based on a lecture series that he did.
Okay.
And I could probably find it. I need to post this anyway.
Yeah.
The lecture series is online. I think he did it at Princeton Seminary.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I would love that. And by the way, it's interesting you mentioned that, because that's something that one of my professors helped me to do, and that is understand the value of listening.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually listen a lot to lectures, to podcasts, to those kinds of things. And those are also informing me, you know, all the time.
And so what are some of your favorites of those?
Okay, so Al Mohler, president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, has this daily briefing.
Uh-huh.
And it's just 20 minutes. And he uploads it like by 6 or 6:30 in the morning. And he's basically taking the headlines of that day and commenting on like 2 or 3 or 4 of those. And so that's helping me, you know, keep attuned to what's going on in the culture at large and in like the New York Times, the Financial Times of London or whatever that is. And so that's serving me in that way. So I don't have to read the Financial Times of London or the New York Times. Now I have a, you know, when Google Reader died, I got on Feedly.
Yep.
And so I have the New York Times feed, the BBC feed, and Yahoo News feed. And so every morning I'm actually going through all the headlines.
Yeah.
You know, so that's kind of informing me on a daily basis what's going on in the world. You know, like for example, Noah is the big news, you know, the Noah movie.
Yeah.
So you know, I'm trying to read some reviews here and there. So I'm always trying to gather information and trying to be somewhat informed, though I'm not deeply engrossed in reading blogs all day and stuff like that, but more reading the headlines. And if there's something that catches my eye, you know, then I'm going to click that link. And
any other podcasts or lectures you found helpful?
So Mohler has the briefing, which is daily, which is really, I don't understand how he does it, but every single day, Monday through Friday, it's about 20 minutes and it's really helpful. He also has one called Thinking in Public. And that one is very helpful too, because that's more about an hour long podcast and it comes out every so many weeks or so many months. And what he's doing is he's engaging mainly with secular authors. On occasion, he'll deal with a non-secular author. So, for example, he interviewed, his last one was George Marsden on his latest book on the Enlightenment. So where that's helpful is, you know, we don't have time to read everything, but he's engaging with authors that are writing pretty important books.
Yeah.
And he's fleshing through their, you know, what they're arguing and the different chapters and the different thoughts. And so I can get a sense, you know, of Marsden's book without having read it, if I don't have time to read it right now, or maybe someone else's book. So he's interviewed, I think, Mark Regnerus, who's a sociologist here at UT Austin, and also Dr. Will Inboden, who is at the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Policy here.
Yeah.
You know, he's interviewing intellectuals about important books they're writing, and I just find that helpful as well.
Yeah.
I've tried other podcasts, but those are primarily the two that I'm faithful to. Now what's funny is I will listen to my sermon every week.
Yeah.
We have a podcast.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm my biggest critic, but it's one of the things I do.
That's a discipline
Mondays.
Right there.
Yes. Cause I know the guys on Tuesday are going to come at me. And so I want to make sure that I understood what I said. And
right.
And
you just use like the iTunes and the podcast.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
iTunes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll wind this down, but let me ask you, two questions. One of them will be the easy one. Let me ask you the harder one. What What have we not covered that you think might be helpful to share with someone who's a newer, younger preacher or an experienced preacher from your own learnings? Because you've been doing this a while, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've been in ministry a long time, but I've been a senior pastor who's been preaching every Sunday since 2000.
Yeah.
My undergraduate degree is in music, and I remember playing in the jazz band in college. And I remember taking a jazz improv class, and what was interesting is that in taking jazz improv, you listen to a lot of people, and you're listening all the time, and what you end up doing is copying them. But in your copying them, you're trying to get down what they're doing, but eventually you come up with your own style. And in preaching, there is some of that that happens, but I think one of the greatest dangers for young preachers is they want to be John Piper, or they want to be Louis Giglio, or they want to be Tim Keller, and or they want to be Charles Spurgeon, or, you know, it's funny how many people want to be Charles Spurgeon and not work on their sermon all week and just start on Saturday night. You know, only Charles Spurgeon could do that because he was reading 7 books a week, and he was just preaching out of the overflow of all the information he was taking in. And so I think there's a danger among young preachers that we are attracted to certain preachers, and we become imitators, you know. So whether it's Mark Driscoll or Tim Keller or John Piper or whatever it is, I think we have to be very careful. And I think what I would encourage young preachers is to find your own voice as quickly as possible. You know, you don't have to, you're not Piper, you're not Lloyd Jones, you're not Driscoll, you're not any of these guys, you're not Matt Chandler. If you understand that preaching is just shepherding, and you're just trying to get people from where they are to present them mature in Christ. You know, it's funny, Rick Warren in his book, The Purpose-Driven Church, I can't believe I'm quoting this, but it's funny, he says something in there that's really powerful, and that is, some people like crowds, but they don't like people. And I think sometimes young preachers are tempted to preach in a way because they like crowds, but they don't want to do the people work. And so just that, the danger of, you know, preaching is so unique in so many ways, and we have to fight sin in so many ways because pride comes so easily.
Yeah.
You know, we might be tempted to preach for crowds, for compliments. It's just so dangerous. And so maybe that's the other thing I would say is guard your heart all the time. You know, you're not as good as you think you are, but things are not as bad as you think they might be either.
It's funny. I think a little game that God plays with me is the less I feel like I did well on a sermon, the more positive feedback I get.
Yeah.
And the better I feel like it went, the less feedback I get.
That's right.
So I think that's God's just way of saying you're not really the one who's doing all this. So.
That's right. God is merciful to us.
Well, if somebody wants to keep up with what's happening with you, do you, what's the church's website? Do you blog or tweet or any of those things?
Yeah. Yeah. Our website is highpointaustin.org, and the point is with an E. So highpointaustin.org. And I do have a Twitter account. It's at Maynor1, MANORJUAN. And people ask, why Maynor1? Well, I actually live in Maynor.
Yeah.
And it just seemed logical.
Yeah.
You know, Juan Sanchez is the equivalent in Spanish of what John Smith is in English.
Sure.
You know, so so there are Juans all over the place. So that was a way to distinguish myself. And Juan Sanchez and Pastor Juan were already taken up on Twitter.
Right. Fair enough.
So. I do have a blog. I've been inactive because I've been trying to finish up some work. I hope to re-engage in that more and more. And so right now I'm about once a week putting up our weekly newsletter article on my blog. And that's straight to the heart, all letters, point, highpointaustin.org.
Got it.
Great. And so, you know, we're in Northeast Austin off of Palmer Lane, off the Interstate 35 and then Dessau Road. And, you know, we meet at 10 o'clock on Sunday mornings and at 5 o'clock on Sunday evenings. And, you know, anyone's welcome to come by. And one of the things I haven't said is, I don't preach any longer on Sunday nights necessarily. But one of the things that we're trying to do is actually develop preachers.
Yeah.
So that's when some of our other staff preaches on Sunday night, and some of the guys that we're equipping to preach. And so those are really fun times to see guys develop in their preaching as well.
Yeah, I love that you're trying to find opportunities for others too. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
So, well, thanks so much, Juan.
Well, you're very
it's
welcome.
Pleasure to have you.
Yeah, it's fun to reconnect again, John.
Yeah, well, we occasionally bump into each other in coffee shops, it seems.
That's right.
So
that's right.
We might as well make it happen online.
So which is your favorite coffee shop in Austin now?
Oh, I go to Houndstooth Coffee
okay.
Central
okay.
all the time, yeah.
Okay.
I'm there way too much.
Okay, I've seen you at Cafe Medici.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes when I go downtown, I'll end up there.
Okay, so, see you around town then.
Yeah. Well, blessings to you.
Blessings to you too, brother.
Thanks for listening. If you go to sermonsmith.com, you can find notes from each show that we've done so far. There's links that have been mentioned by the guests. We're building a little database of books and gear that each of the guests have mentioned, and so you can see who's mentioned each of them, and it links back to each of their interviews. You can also find us on Twitter, at Sermon Smith. You can find us on Facebook by searching for Sermon Smith. Using the website, Twitter, all of that, if you could help spread the word, the best way people are finding this podcast and any podcast is through word of mouth. Another thing you could consider doing is leaving us a positive review on iTunes, or, well, any review, from what I hear, is a good thing on iTunes. Finally, if you're enjoying the show, this is part of my bivocational ministry that I'm doing this. So if you'd consider doing a donation of some kind, whether some sort of ongoing monthly donation at the level of a monthly latte or ebook, or a one-time donation, you can go to the website and click on the donate link. There's also ways that you can support the site there through third-party affiliate links. Thanks again. Thanks for listening, and we will be back with a new interview in a few weeks.